Sono per fare la Vado a suffer. One of the problems about which Bhagavan was often asked was suffering. The question was usually personal rather than academic, since it was the experience of grief which drove people to seek solace from him. The real solace came as a silent influence. But he did also answer theoretical questions. The usual answer was to bid the questioner find out who it is that suffers, just as he would bid the doubter to find out who it is that doubts. For the self is beyond suffering, and it is beyond doubt. Sometimes, however, on a more contingent level, he would point out that whatever makes a person dissatisfied with a state of ignorance and turns him to the quest of the self is beneficial, and that is often suffering, which is the means of doing this. But he also often asked him, if God is perfect and all-loving, why does he make us suffer?
Yeah.
that was a common question. How can he cause suffering? Bhagavan, the bliss of self is always yours, and you will find it if you seek it earnestly. The cause of your misery is not in your outer life. It is in you as your ego. You impose limitations on yourself, and then make a vain struggle to transcend them. All unhappiness is due to the ego. With it comes all your trouble. What does it avail you to attribute the cause of misery to the happenings of life, when that cause is really within you? What happiness can you get from things extraneous to yourself? When you get it, how long will it last? If you would deny the ego and scorch it by ignoring it, you would be free. If you accept it, it will impose limitations on you and throw you into the vain struggle to transcend them. That was how the thieves sought to ruin King Janak. To be the self that you really are is the only means to realize the bliss that is ever yours. A very devoted and simple devotee had lost his only son, a child of three. The next day he arrived at the ashram with his family. Referring to them, Bhagavan said, Training of mind helps one to bear sorrows and bereavements with courage. But the loss of one's children is said to be the worst of all griefs. Grief only exists as long as one considers oneself to have a definite form. If the form is transcended, one knows the oneself to be eternal. There's neither death nor birth. What is born is only the body, and this is the creation of the ego. But the ego is not ordinarily perceived without the body, and so is identified with it. It is thought that matters. Let the sensible man or woman, doesn't say that, consider whether he knew his body while in deep sleep. Why then does he feel it in the waking state? Although the body was not felt in sleep, didn't the self exist? What was his state when in deep sleep? And what is it now when awake? What is the difference? The ego rises up, and that is waking. Simultaneously, thoughts arise. Find out who has the thoughts. Where do they come from? They must arise from the conscious self. Apprehending this even vaguely helps towards the extinction of the ego. The realization of the one infinite existence becomes possible. In that state, there are no individuals but only eternal beings. Hence, there is no thought of death or grieving. Devotee, if someone we love dies, it causes grief. Should we avoid such grief by either loving all alike or not loving at all? Bhagavan, if someone we love dies, it causes grief to the one who continues living. The way to get rid of grief is not to continue living. Okay, pass out knives. It would be so easy, right? Bhagavan said they kill the body for the suffering of the mind. You know, these people commit suicide. Oh. Kill the griever, and who then will remain to grieve? The ego must die. That is the only way. The two alternatives you suggest amount to the same. When all are realized to be the one self, who is there to love or hate? Sometimes, however, the questions were impersonal, referring to not some private tragedy, but to the evil and suffering in the world. Question: widespread distress such as famine and pestilence. Pestilence means what?
Disease.
Disease. Spreads havoc through the world. What is the cause of this state of affairs? Answer: to whom does all this appear? Questioner: that won't do. I see misery all around. Answer: you were not conscious of the world and its sufferings while asleep, but you are now that you are awake. Continue in the state in which you are not affected by such things. When you are not aware of the world, that is to say, when you remain as the self in the state of sleep, its sufferings do not affect you. Therefore, turn inwards and seek the self, and there will be an end, both of the world and its misery. Questioner: but that is selfishness. Answer: the world is not external to you. Because you wrongly identify yourself with the body, you see the world outside and its sufferings, and its suffering becomes apparent to you. But the world and its sufferings are not real. Seek the reality and get rid of this unreal feeling. Note, this the visitor was unwilling to do, but instead referred again to suffering and to those who strive vainly to remove it. Questioner: there are great men and public workers who cannot solve the problem of suffering in the world. Answer: that is because they are based on the ego. If they remain in the self, it would be different. Note: still presuming the absolute reality of the objective world, the visitor now asked, in an indirect way, how it would be different, demanding that those who abide in the self should accept the unreal as real. Question: why don't Mahatmas help? For the moment, Bhagavan answers on the visitor's own level. Answer: how do you know that they don't? Public speeches, outer activity, and material help are all outweighed by the silence of the Mahatmas. They accomplish more than others. Now the visitor comes to the practical point. Outer activity instead of inner quest. And Bhagavan rejects the viewpoint no less categorically. Questioner, what can we do to ameliorate the condition of the world? Answer, if you remain free from pain, there will be no pain anywhere. The trouble now is due to your seeing the world outside yourself and thinking there is pain in it. But both the world and the pain are within you. If you turn inwards, there will be no pain. Questioner, God is perfect. Why did he create the world imperfect? A work partakes of its nature, of the nature of its author. But in this case, it is not so. Answer, are you something separate from God that you should ask this question? So long as you consider yourself the body, you see the world as external to you. It is to you that the imperfection appears. God is perfection, and his work is also perfection. But you see it as imperfect because of your wrong identification with the body or the ego. Question. Why did the self manifest as this miserable world? Not giving it up. When the last time I took my father out, you know, I took him to this Chinese restaurant. He couldn't get out because he couldn't walk, but I bought these, what are those long things?
Fortune cookies.
What?
Chopsticks.
What?
Chopsticks.
No. You eat it and it's round.
Swim roll.
Yeah, he liked these a lot, you know. I used to get them before. So I took him down to the Niagara River. You know, we're right near the river there. It was a beautiful sunny day. The water was calm, you know, in front of the river, and you know, I gave him that, and he started eating them, and I thought, how wonderful, you know, look at this outside and beautiful sunny day, calm river before us, you know, pretty vast and everything, and he used to, you know, spend a lot of time in the river, and this is his hometown, and he started eating, and he said, this is hell. I mean, he had trouble holding it, you know.
Oh.
And he remembers all his
when he was
activity when he was young and on the river and the boats and all over, you know, he's near his business there.
Yeah.
And he's thinking of those things. And
yeah.
He's not just looking right now. What I thought would be just the opposite, you know. So we make the hell. Why did the self manifest as this miserable world? Answer, in order that you might seek it. Your eyes cannot see themselves, but if you hold a mirror in front of them, they see themselves. Creation is the mirror. See yourself first, and then see the whole world as the self. Question. Then, what it amounts to is that I should always turn inwards? Answer, yes. Question, shouldn't I see the world at all? Answer, you are not told to shut your eyes to the world, but only to see yourself first, and then see the whole world as the self. If you consider yourself as the body, the whole world appears to be external. If you are the self, the world appears as Brahman manifested. Note, finally, a quotation which shows how Bhagavan sometimes answered on a more contingent plane, pointing out that it is suffering that makes a man discontented with the life of the ego and spurs him on to seek self-realization. Question, why should there be suffering? Answer, if there were no suffering, how could the desire to be happy arise? If that desire did not arise, how could the quest of the self arise? Question, then is all suffering good? Answer, yes. What is happiness? Is it a healthy and handsome body, regular meals, and so on? Even an emperor has endless troubles, although he may be in good health. So all suffering is due to the false notion, I am the body. Getting rid of this is knowledge. Okay, this is, I guess, a poem or a conversation by B.A. Rao called Anatta. I was walking along the road when I met a fool talking fool talk. There isn't one, there isn't one. How happy I am, there isn't one. He said, as if it was a song he was singing. Isn't one what? I asked. Isn't one me? He said foolishly. And he walked on looking quite happy.
I did not know that.
Isn't one what? There isn't one. Isn't one what? Isn't one me? I guess he thinks he's everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not an individual. Reality by L.P. Yundero. Many roles, but one actor. Many masks, but one face. This, and seeming separate that. This and that, I guess. The life and all successive lives. Okay. The Four Noble Truths by Bodhicitta. It is through not understanding, it is through not understanding, through not penetrating the Four Noble Truths, O bhikkhus, that we have wandered around this long, long journey of rebirth, both you and I. What are these four? The truth of suffering. The truth of the cause of suffering. The truth of the ceasing of suffering. And the truth of the way to the ceasing of suffering. That's a quote from Digha Nikaya. Buddhism starts from the postulate of suffering, that there is suffering, that there is a cause for suffering, and that there is a cure for suffering. This is not pessimism. Pessimism and optimism are emotional attitudes, whereas this is more like a medical diagnosis. Cool, clinical, unemotional, a statement, not of opinion, but fact. Such is the condition, such is its cause, such is its cure. Take it or leave it, it is up to you. The diagnosis that there is suffering does not mean that life is all pain and no pleasure. That would be patently untrue. It means that man is vulnerable to events and conditions, that he is liable to bereavement and apt to be forced into association with people and things he dislikes and separation from those he likes. That as he grows old, his health and powers fail, and he is crushed by sickness and old age, and finally extinguished by death. It means, in fine, that so far as a man considers himself an individual being, he is foredoomed to frustration ending in extermination, however many pleasures or triumphs there may be on the way. If anyone says that he likes it so, and considers the pleasures of life worth the price, all right, it is up to him. A doctor only diagnoses. He does not try to force his treatment on the patient. If an alcoholic is killing himself, but prefers to go on doing so when by abstention he could recover his health and prolong his life, the doctor can only warn him. It is up to him. The second basic truth, that there is a cause for suffering.
This is like Schopenhauer, the philosopher that said, life is an endless pain with a painful end.
There is a cause for suffering, implies the third, that there is a cure for it, since it often happens, as in the case of the alcoholic, that removal of the cause produces a cure. The cause of suffering is the false belief that one is a separate individual being. But this is a statement of deceptive simplicity. It sounds as though a mere change of mental outlook could eliminate suffering, which is absurd. A man could read and agree with an exposition of anatta and straight afterwards overeat and suffer for it. And his change of outlook would not help him at all. The trouble goes far deeper. Belief in an ego cannot be merely theoretical, since it obsesses also children and uneducated persons who know nothing of theory. If it is productive to tanha, that is of thirst or craving, it is also a product of tanha. It is deep-rooted. Since it is not a mental creation, a mental change is not enough to eradicate it. One can understand that the ego is fictitious and yet continue to desire its appreciation by other egos, or its triumph over them, and to crave its sense satisfaction. Thus, just as the second basic truth, that there is a cause for suffering, leads on to the third, that there is a cure for suffering, so the third calls for the fourth, that there is a path to this cure. And with the fourth, the doctrine becomes dynamic. The first basic truth is a diagnosis, a mere statement of observation, and life bears its truth in upon one. The second is a deduction with which intelligent consideration shows to be true. The third results from the second, as in the case of an alcoholic. Removal of the cause will remove the effect. But it is much more complicated than the case of the alcoholic, because only willpower is needed in abstaining from alcohol, whereas it requires a great skill to unmask and renounce the ego. Therefore, with the fourth truth comes the prescription. Although still dispassionate, the doctor is now dynamic. He has finished his diagnosis and is telling you now what course of treatment you must take if you want to get better. Suffering is caused by the false belief in an ego. This produces and is produced by tanha. Therefore, one can say that suffering is due to tanha, that's thirst or craving, and can be removed by the elimination of tanha. I took a course once on existentialism at college, it's called The Cause of Suffering. Uh-huh. I had it figured out then. I raised my hand. I said, the cause is desire. Uh-huh. You know? And he said, it's not so simple.
Simple. Simple. Oh, okay.
Then he went on to go over and over, and I didn't go back the next day. So, this is equivalent to the elimination of the ego. Okay, so one is brought up against the question, what is the path of whose existence the fourth basic truth assures us? And the answer is the Noble Eightfold Way. This is not a series of successive steps of which one must be completed before the next is undertaken. And no school of Buddhism uses it as such. It is simply an amplification of the fourth basic truth, describing the path that is necessary. It is to be noted that right understanding precedes right speech and action on the list. Discipline of life will not of itself dissolve the illusion of an ego and eliminate suffering. It may indeed increase the inner stress, which is so large a cause of suffering, since if a man does not understand why he is curbing his tanha, he is likely to develop inner resentment, secretly longing to indulge it, deliberately chosen or inflicted by outside circumstances or by enemies. Hardship does not of itself purify the ego or enlighten the mind. It is only likely to produce useful results if undertaken with intelligent purpose. Just as mental understanding of the doctrine of anatta is of little use without practical efforts to realize it, so, on the other hand, practical discipline of life is not likely to be very effective without understanding of the doctrine which demands it. Before right understanding can produce right living, which includes thought, speech, and action, it must be vitalized by right aspiration and thus cease to be merely theoretical. And therefore, right aspiration comes second on the list. There is the well-known tag of the Latin poet, "I know and admire the better way, but I follow the worse." Whether as blatantly cynical as this or not, understanding may remain sterile. It is aspiration which vitalizes it and puts it in control of one's way of living. Thus only it becomes dynamic. And thus it changes the nature of man from one vulnerable to events and mortgaged to suffering, to one liberated from suffering and untouched by the flow of events.
Who wrote that one?
You know, it says Bodhicitta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think this may be him also.
Oh, okay.
His Buddhist name. For Buddhist writing. He's got one for Muslim. He's got one for English. That's Sagittarius. Sagittarius. What?
How about Christian? Does he have a name for Christian?
Well, the Sagittarius one, I think. Mm. He writes some. Suffering is cause and cure according to the Isha Upanishad by Madhguni Shambhupat. The Isha Upanishad comes first in the traditional sequence of the 108 greater Upanishads, about which I wrote in a previous article. It belongs to the Yajur Veda, and its chief characteristic is its insistence on the identity between the Isha, or Supreme Being, and his creatures. It opens with an enunciation of oneness, quote, "The Lord covers all," unquote. That being so, it continues, "You should practice renunciation, utilizing only enough for your bare needs, and not grabbing at wealth or of anyone else. How can you grab if you recognize that everything belongs to the Lord? This does not mean that you should not live a full life. Indeed, the next verse encourages you to aim at living the full lifespan of 100 years and says that you can do this by right activity. It contains the emphatic statement that is the only way by which you can live without becoming burdened by the responsibility for good and bad action. Thus, these opening sentences of the first Upanishad lay the utmost stress on detached activity and a policy of live and let live for the attainment of happiness as long as life in this world and supreme bliss at the end. The remaining mantras of the Upanishad for each of the verses as the mantra further reinforce this advice, as do the remaining 107 Upanishads. This attitude of detached activity, live and let live, is fundamental to Hindu ethics and philosophy. It underlies our daily prayer, may all be happy, may all be healthy, may all enjoy prosperity, may none grieve. With such an approach, this Upanishad is naturally very impersonal. Even the comprehensive term Brahma finds no place in it. I thought he's going to give us the verses. No. The theory and practice according to Sri Ramana. Oh, it's not very long. I'll read in faith.
By whom?
Rama Subramanyam. 10. In the article Suffer Little Children on page 10 of our issue in January 1966, the author tells how his two sons enjoyed the grace of Sri Bhagavan. The writer of the present article is the elder of them, now grown to maturity. All about philosophy. Philosophy is more often a battlefield than a meeting place for theories and theorists. Widely differing views are most about philosophy. And the nature and significance of tapas. That is the wrong one also. And then Jesu Dazan S.J. That's the Society of Jesuits, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Vicarious suffering. Must be the Christian thing. A lot of suffering here.
Lots of suffering.
Which then of your Lord's bounties will you reject? By Abdullah Qutbuddin. Aspects of Islam. Number 12. This is and then the cult of suffering, Sagittarius.
He's written a lot about suffering.
Is this all issue on suffering or what?
This issue on suffering, of course. Minnows in the Seven Seas by an anonymous seeker. In 1955, I had been meditating enthusiastically for some months after reading Ramana Maharshi and the Path of Self-Knowledge by Arthur Osborne. Got a plug in there. When I had a very striking experience. Sitting at my desk in the office one day, I turned my gaze inwards to the Atman. The peace and joy I customarily felt in meditation began to rise up, but much more than usual. When it attained a certain level, I suddenly felt a sensation of objectivity as real on its own plane as that of physical objects on the material plane. I felt the upper part of my body enclosed in a sort of sphere extending several feet on either side and above my head. I did not lose consciousness of my physical surroundings, and yet at the same time I was aware of a scene taking place on the inner firmament behind my head, which could only be described as the Son of Man coming on a cloud with a power and glory. I don't remember this part of the vision very well, but his face was like the sun, and rays of light streamed forth from it. In his right hand he held a shepherd's crook.
That's a benchy.
Crook.
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 Crook. Crook.
Stick?
Yeah, you know, the shepherd. Oh. There's a picture of Christ. He's supposed to be the shepherd.
Yeah.
Okay. He held a crook. The impression he gave was one of overwhelming goodness. His love was tremendous, but at the same time severe. It seemed to say, "If you walk in my way and follow my commandments, you will be all right. But if you don't, you must take the consequences." It also seemed capable of relentless cruelty, of watching the most terrible suffering without a trace of sympathy in spite of the severity. However, the love was so vast that it seemed it would wait a million years for me alone, that it would go through fire for me. It was tremendously humble, seeming to say, "Almost anything I will do for you, my beloved." In spite of this humility, however, it was endured, and I must emphasize this, with incredible majesty, power, and authority. With the approach of the vision, the joy increased. I felt that I could ask questions and be answered. If I began to ask something, the thought would be taken up and we would end by asking it together. Then he would answer. I asked, "Should I be doing this instead of working at my job?" He's in his office, right?
He's in his office.
He must be, nobody's there. No one's coming to ask him any questions. You know.
Yeah.
Probably got his own business or something. You know. I asked, "Should I be doing this instead of working at my job?" He said, "All time is mine." As he drew nearer and this incredibly holy peace and joy increased, the realization suddenly burst upon me from all sides of the inner scene. Why? This is me. That did not only apply to the symbol in the inner firmament, but to the firmament itself. And God said, "Yes," and encouraged me to look at him and to absorb the realization that I, who am sitting here writing this, am also he, and that he is no farther away from me than my very life, and never has been, and that he sees out of my eyes, for I am he. As he came closer, I realized that I had been looking for this all my life, but in the wrong direction, that I couldn't move a finger without looking for God in the wrong direction. With the increase of the inner joy, my consciousness was withdrawing from the outer world. The joy was so great, it seemed to me that even millions of years of most terrible suffering would be worth enduring it to attain it. The saying, "millions of years," I want to convey the idea of immeasurably vast periods, even longer than that. In fact, as I then said, "Anything is worth this," and he said, "Yes." This means that any price at all, no matter how great, no matter if it is a millions of years or millions of kalpas of the most frightful suffering, is worth paying for the attainment of so great a joy. It may not be possible to imagine so great a joy, but remember that this is far above the petty personalized emotions of life. This joy was so splendid, so noble and regal, that it reminded me of a king walking along in a hall of this his great palace, the Lord of the universe. As the vision came nearer, the peace and joy and bliss increased so much that it seemed that sin, sorrow, death, and suffering were but words without meaning, swallowed up by joy. Like minnows in the seven seas, all the suffering that has ever been in this universe is swallowed up like minnows in the seven seas when compared to so great a joy. It must on no account be supposed that this is an exaggeration. The exact analogy that occurred to me at that time was of an ordinary household bucket, a third full of water, with a few minnows swimming around it, being poured out into the seven seas. There was nothing dreamy or hazy about this, quite the contrary. It was so vividly conscious that in comparison with it, ordinary everyday consciousness seemed that of a dream. Still, this great joy rolled down on me. I began to feel that I contained all knowledge within myself. I knew why things were as they were, why this was so, and this, why every single atom in the universe is just what it is. It seemed to me that there were things which I could not bring down from the higher self to the lower for reasons of karma, but that the lower self was dissolving into the infinite ocean of bliss and knowledge. Consciousness of the outer world was now very dim, and I was no longer thinking, but the inner consciousness was crystal clear, vivid, spotless, like the infinite clear blue sky. As I poised on the very brink before losing the last vestige of outer consciousness, there came to me the feeling of returning home. Then I was completely absorbed into the eternal void. After that, my consciousness seemed to split in two again, and I had to come back to Earth. As the higher self was withdrawing, it had the attitude of being very pleased that it had been able to serve me like that. I had been absorbed in the Absolute. My ego, the thing experienced, and experience had all merged in one. How can the mind conceive of it? What the experience reminded me of most strongly was a man who, for millions of years, had been living completely pure and upright amid unspeakable degradation, suddenly being released and rushing around in a frenzy of joy to find that in the end everything had, after all, been worthwhile. It seemed as if the entire universe was for him alone. Even the very stars were shining for him. However, there is no time or space in that state, so this is only an analogy. In this state, time is the continuation of 1 second. Thus, time moves vertically, not horizontally. It is a different quality of experience from anything in time and space. While I could still ask questions and be answered, I asked whether I would become a Jivan Mukta, realized while living in this lifetime. Then he showed me the future of this life, and the answer was no. Sorry. That is to say, in the normal course of events, although I could, he said, he showed me my future in the form of a line drawn to represent my spiritual progress, with many intricate risings and fallings to varying heights and depths, with various achievements at different rates. Altogether, he showed me a total of 4 incarnations into the future, the purpose being to show me a test I shall have to face in my next life in India, and that I must prepare for it if I am to pass it. The results of passing or failing this test were shown to me in the next 2 lives. There are many degrees of ecstasy. When I began my sadhana, I found after a few weeks that I was daily experiencing ecstasy. Then I experimented with rhythmic breathing for a few weeks, and this type of ecstasy vanished and was replaced by a more peaceful sensation in meditation. Subsequently, I found that these ecstasies were used by the ego as a last refuge to prevent its annihilation. I had been blinded by them and had lost sight of the goal through concentrating on them instead of on the Atman. This is a common mistake. When I came out of my samadhi, I saw something about its essence which immediately reminded me about the Maharshi. He went direct to the self and did not stop for anything on the way. Truly such advanced souls are far above us. They wear human bodies but are not human. They have transcended their karma and are Allah unto themselves. How can one ever understand the glory of a Jivan Mukta? It must be a foreigner, right?
Mm-hmm.
What?
You would be born as an Indian in this expert.